The Offside Rule. We get it with Lindsay Hooper.
Welcome to the Offside Rule podcast. Thanks for downloading podcast 3. Coming up this week, I head to Sparrows Lane and interview Charlton manager Chris Powell. Hear his thoughts on the England back four and how football has changed in his time as a player and now manager. Ed Draper joins myself and Kate Borsay for a roundtable chat. For the first time, we're tackling the issue of the Offside Rule. We thought we should do what it says on the tin. We're also picking out players we'd have round as dinner guests. See if you agree with any of our choices. Finally, Five Live reporter and the first female commentator on Match of the Day, Jackie Oatley, shares some insight into her career and some highlights. So let's begin.
The female take on football.
Lindsay Hooper, joined by Chris Powell at Sparrow Lane, at Charlton's training ground. Welcome to the Offside Rule podcast.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. First of all, you were shortlisted for Manager of the Month. Obviously, things are going very well at Charlton for you. Look at the outstanding start you've had, and I'm wondering, just regarding the whole leagues, which managers have impressed you? Because you've had a great start, but there are other managers as well being talked about and who you've been watching.
Well, yeah, I mean, I obviously concentrate on League One, but I do look at all four divisions and non-league. I mean, obviously Manchester City have made some big statements this year. You know, I'm pleased for Newcastle, Alan Pardew, with what he's had to do with regards to moving players on and just getting in players that not too many people have heard about, and fashioned a real good team and fostered a good team spirit there. I think when you look at the Championship, I think Nigel at Southampton's a good man who I've spoken to on a few occasions, and he's really got them going. It's good to see West Ham up there, of course. You know, they're fancy, they need to be up there. But, you know, looking at Crystal Palace, Dougie Freeman, someone I've met on coaching courses and met socially, I'm pleased that he's getting a new career for himself as manager of a club that, he's got legendary status at. People like that have done well, obviously, in my league. You know, the usual suspects are around, Lee Clark and two Sheffields and MK Dons. And, you know, it's going to be a tough season for us. And then you look at Crawley coming up and Southend Mile Club. I was there for over 5 years. Pleased that they can finally be in the upper reaches of that league and maybe get themselves up next season. And then you see Wrexham in the conference, you know, a club that has had real trouble times recently and lost their manager this year, but in Dean Saunders, but, you know, they're still up there, and Luton Town. So, I mean, I love football and I do look at the other leagues, but of course I do concentrate on League One.
It's great to speak to someone who loves all areas of football, especially the non-league. I mean, I did quite a lot in non-league as well. Okay. I'm going to take you to the other side of the spectrum, though, to England. And with your England experience and your experience as a player, just with the England setup at the moment, who would you have as your back four? Would you go with youth, or would you stick with the Terry Ferdinand, perhaps, partnership?
I think, of course, it's Fabio's job, and good luck, because he's got a wealth of good players. But, you know, I think Chris Smalling and Phil Jones have really impressed me, and Cahill in an England shirt. So he's got, an embarrassment of riches, really, but it's more a case of getting a solid back four, a four that know one another in the short time they're together, because they don't get the time to work on the real sort of intricacies of a back four forming a good relationship, or a back five with the keeper. So I think you try to get the right balance, you strive to get the right balance of players that have been through it, such as Ashley Cole and John Terry, and then you look at maybe can you put a Jones or a Cahill next to him, or Smalling at right back, because then you have the balance of the young, energetic sort of players that really want to do well and impress, and you've got the players that have been there, seen it and done it. And if you can marry the two together with a good young keeper in Joe Hart, then I think you get the right balance. But of course Fabio will see them day to day and see them week in, week out, when he goes and watches them, and obviously he chooses it. But you know, maybe that's the way I would look at it.
Later on in this podcast, in my roundtable, we're going to discuss the Offside Rule and Franz Beckenbauer saying that really it could be do with simplifying, not back to the olden days, but certainly the active and inactive element. Is that something that you agree with? Would you like to see that introduced?
I think there are certain areas that could be improved on with regards to inactive and active. I think you could make that a bit clearer. It isn't easy, and the hardest thing is it's hard for assistant referees, I nearly said linesmen there. It's hard for them because at times they should put the flag up, but under their own rulings, they're not allowed to do it until the ball's been touched by someone, and it kind of infuriates people, and they're only doing their job, and they're only being doing exactly what the rules and laws are. So I think there is a scope for change. Not drastic change, as you say, but definitely there is room for improvement, shall we say.
Finally, in your time in football, from playing through to management, and a lot has happened, looking at wages, looking at things like rule changes, yeah. And now, of course, the current row as well. I mean, have we got any further with kicking things like racism out of the game and all the protests that we go through week on week? There's a lot of that in the press at the moment. How far do you think it's come?
Well, football, football's for all. It should be enjoyed by everyone, and people support Arsenal, or they support Accrington Stanley, but I don't think there should be that much of a difference in regards to how they're treated. You know, I feel it's a game that, you know, is loved by all, loved by many. It's a game that can unite people on and off the field. It can unite people from different races. It's a wonderful sport, and I feel we can always use football to improve things in our communities, in society. And I think we should adhere to that more and see if we can improve that. And I think we all have a duty, whatever level, to do our best and make sure it's a good and safe environment for people to watch and for people to play.
Have you got any suggestions, though, with regards to keeping across that? I mean, certainly with crowds, I mean, it's hard to say what people can or cannot chant, isn't it, in a crowd, in a football crowd. It's hard to administer. I mean, they've had that in the SPL as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to, you know, really put down legislation with regards to what you chant, what's banter, what's not banter, where do you cross the line. We have a duty to do right. What 11 players go out there to play it in the right spirit. We have a duty also when we're off the field to behave correctly and to just do our best in light of what's happened recently on and off the field, allegedly. We always know that things can rear its ugly head, you know, incidents that you don't want to see happen. So, you know, I for one, just like us to, you know, really try and improve things. You know, I can't stand here or sit here and say to you, well, UEFA and FIFA and the FA, and they all have to come together in some shape or form and try to improve things in their own specific countries, in Europe and in the world. You know, we have the World Cup, we have the Euros, and they're always well organised. And I just want us to get things organised as much as we can, especially in our own country. I think that's our first calling, is what we do in England. And hopefully that will inspire other countries and other people to improve their own football in their own countries.
Thank you very much for speaking to me. There's a little note on the wall here, and I told Gary, your PR manager, football speak the banned list from interviews. So there's, to be fair, decent, by the way, obviously. And we need to add you know on there. Now, you were very good, but I'm sure a few of your players slip that in, don't they?
I say you know sometimes, and obviously I'm still doing my best to not say it, but to be fair, by the way, no, I mean, it's something we've always done here. The press guys, Gary and Matt and their team have done it, and I'm quite conscious whenever I'm talking to people to not say those things, but I bet I have. I'm sure I have.
Well, I was counting those up. It says 50p, fine, and I can say you're in the clear, naught.
Well, I'll pay some money if I have to, no problem. It all goes to a good cause.
Apparently.
Thanks very much.
The female take on football.
Thanks again to Chris Powell. And on reflection, we can also add to that banned list the phrases game of two halves and there or thereabouts. If you can think of any more, then add some comments below this podcast and I promise to pass them on to the Charlton media team. Next, it's time for my roundtable.
The female take on football.
Well, it's time for my round table for another week. I'm joined by Kate Borsay, a regular in the studio.
Hiya.
Thanks for joining us again. And in a loose women sense, you know, on loose women, when they always have a guy that comes in and is the honorary male, we've got that today. Ed Draper, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for letting me be your honorary male member, Lindsay. Pleasure to be
You're
here.
An honorary woman in a way for
yes.
today.
Oh, I also feel like that.
We'll start off with the first topic, and quite good, really, because the podcast's called The Offside Rule, and it's our first offside rule debate. And this is all courtesy of Franz Beckenbauer, who's been talking about simplifying the offside rule and that it would be good for the game. He's not suggesting by any means that we should go back to the dark old ages of just the old-fashioned offside. But when it comes to active and inactive players, I think he thinks it's too complicated. There are some inconsistencies, which I'd agree with, and that it should all be changed. Now, what do we think of that? We'll start with our guest, Ed.
Well, I think it's interesting, isn't it? France obviously was a sweeper in his time. He was the last man he could call the line. It was very cut and dry. Back then, I mean, you had to be actually in front of the defender to be kind of onside. You couldn't be level, which is, we've progressed towards that, and it's all in aim of getting the game more creative, more goal scoring. But France is looking at it from a sympathetic eye towards defences and saying, you know, how does a back line marshal itself in terms of getting forward and trying to get strikers who are lazy, dragging their heels offside? Because now, if you switch a ball from left back to a sort of right wing, for instance, as an example, the player is onside, the right winger, but the striker in the middle may be sort of doing his shoelaces up, completely, you know, inactive under the new rules, yet can stand up as a right winger bombs down the wing, can cross it in. That striker picks himself up, heads the ball into the net, and under the new rules, that's fine. So I think what France is saying is this inactive, passive, however you want to work, it has to be a little bit more clear-cut, and maybe you eliminate the phases and you say, if a player is offside in the first phase, then he subsequently cannot capitalise on any chance that comes. I think that's probably the way you have to break it down. I don't think we should go back to if someone's behind the back line, they're offside, because it may be they're peripheral, they're on the wing, they're out of the way. In my sort of estimation of the game, trying to make it more creative, more attacking and not negative, because it's very easy for a defence to stand up if someone's injured or whatever, or hobbling back into play. I think it's a good move that players can be deemed passive, but I think they have to be passive for the whole instance is how I read it, and that's probably the change that would need to be made, and it needs to be specified. The referees would need to understand it, and then it'd be implemented, I guess.
Now, it's not just Beckenbauer that's called for this. It's lots of people around the footballing world, and you've mentioned cases there, Ed, where goals have been deemed for a player that was inactive that became active. I mean, there's many, many examples where we've seen that, and I think it's the consistency amongst refereeing that is being also pinpointed here in this statement. And one thing that I wanted to mention with it was the goal line technology, because I think, yes, we don't want to go back to the dark old ages of just, you know, trying to run the last man, but why don't we have something which is backed up by goal line technology or by a kind of an official referee, a video referee, if you like, because that is something that would be able to state whether a player was inactive or active. I mean, there's also this triple punishment that he has brought into it as well regarding the last player, and if he gets a red card, the opposing team get a penalty, and there's a ban as well. So it's like this triple punishment. Is that too much? So on those two themes, Kate, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think it definitely needs to be simplified, and you don't need to survey some of the top players and actually pundits to realise that the offside rule at the moment is not clear enough, and it's become almost a bit of a joke amongst commentators, etc., because it can be manipulated by teams, as we've discussed, because of this active passive business. But I think it just needs to be a lot clearer, because there's a whole joke about women not getting the offside rule, and okay, we do get it, but actually it's quite hard to get it when there are so many factors that can relate to whether a player is offside or not, and then subsequently where the goals come from because of that. So I think it just needs to be made simpler in terms of the triple punishment. Yeah, it does seem harsh, doesn't it, to get a red card, then a penalty against their team, and then a subsequent ban as well. So I think perhaps a little more leniency, but again, it has to be done across the board. Too much in football nowadays is up for debate, and when you don't have any amount of video evidence to kind of back anything up, it does become even more tricky. And I just think, you know, it's all very well simplifying the offside rule. It's all very well looking at triple punishment. But are we not missing the real point here? We need some sort of video ref. We need goal line video evidence. We just... we kind of need to be thinking about it in the 21st century, not talking about simplifying rules. We need to get to the bare bones of it, and that's to really look at how we take the game forward in a modern fashion.
Well, I think if you look at the offside, the technology one's a good angle as well, because you've got four potential strikers, say, in a standard team. You've got two wingers, two strikers. You've got the whole inactive, active, who's coming back. You know, the strikers are now in the active thing can be really lazy because they don't have to work the line constantly. They have to get back onside. They can just say, you know, I'm inactive, I'm not playing a part, and then play later part. So you've got four defenders, possibly four attackers, eight players for one single linesman or referee's assistant to determine who was inactive, active at what point, at what phase. It would be a lot more simple if you had a controversial goal and the linesman said at some point this player was offside. Go back to the video ref, decide, determine how many phases back this player was offside, whether he gained an advantage through not getting back onside deliberately, even if it wasn't him receiving the ball on the first pass forward. I think that's a way you probably need to determine it at the highest level in the Premier League, in the Champions League. And then you can make the rule maybe more simplistic and maybe go back to the just simple offside, onside rule lower down your park football, because that's what FIFA have always said. We can't have one rule at the top, one rule at the bottom. But they have in American football, in the NFL, they have in rugby union, rugby league. It's not the same as the school kids playing on a Sunday. They don't have a video ref, but that's the point. It's the higher upper echelon where these decisions impact more for the fans, for the clubs, for their survival financially and, you know, spiritually and whatever.
Yeah, I've always disagreed with that as well, that the grassroots should be an exact replica of what the top game is, because no, it shouldn't. I mean, when I played tennis and I started out at tennis at school, I had a shorter handle on the racket.
No Hawkeye.
Yeah, and no ball girls or boys, which is always a devastating point because you don't want to be running around all day. However, I find that kind of nonsensical in the argument for it. It just seems there's an opposing view to goal line technology for some reason that they will keep debating the rules and the refereeing of it until something comes unstuck.
Can I come back to my favourite person in the whole wide world here? Joseph Blatter. And just say that until a big dramatic move from the top is made. And he did say after Lampard's goal or non-goal at the World Cup, he did say that he would look into goal line. And I haven't heard any more murmuring since. And I think he did that to kind of appease us more than anything else. But someone needs to make a big dramatic stand at the top. Someone like Sepp Blatter, if he wants to get back in our good books and if he really wants to lead world's football governing body, he needs to put a stand down and do something definite like that.
And it's only a few decisions. The standard line is it will suspend the game and everyone's going to get bored and whatnot. But it's only a few instances in a game. If you average a game, say 2.2 goals or whatever it is internationally, you've probably got three or four incidents that lead to goals in the game that you'd have to review. So that's probably a minute. So 4 minutes out of 90 when they played eight or nine added, you know, minutes at the moment anyway. I don't think it's a dramatic, you know, you keep it for goal mouth, goal incidents, offsides that lead, decisions that lead to goals. And I think it'd be fairly simple to implement given the resources at their disposal.
Well, this is a topic that we will readdress in future episodes of the Offside Rule podcast, especially with a guest that I'm lining up at the moment. I'll reveal all at a later date. Let's go on to another topic, and in a come dine with me fashion, because I had a lot of time off last week. It was daytime television time. And I do love that programme. Have you ever seen the one where the snake poos on the table? One to watch. But it was dinner guests. And I thought from the footballing world, you could have three people round for dinner. I want your justifications as to who and why. And this time we'll start with Kate.
Right, so first of all, as a Liverpool fan, predictably, I've gone for a Liverpool connection here. Now, I've gone for someone who I didn't necessarily hear a lot from in my football supporting lifetime, but who is a Liverpool legend, and that's Bob Paisley. Now, Bob took on a Liverpool club which had been built up to great heights by Bill Shankly, but he's kind of forgotten, really. We always talk about how Sir Alex Ferguson is, you know, the kind of manager of a generation, but if you look at what Paisley did in 9 years at Liverpool, he won three European Cups, a UEFA Cup, six league titles and three League Cups, and those three European titles were actually won within the space of five seasons. So he goes down as a god, certainly in my neck of the woods. And what's really fascinating about him is he kind of has this Uncle Bob image, but actually he was really quite ruthless. And when you read some of the comments from his ex-players, you actually get a really good hint of that. After he became a player, he went on to be a physiotherapist before he went into management. And he learned how to self-diagnose problems just by looking at a player. And he's got a great footballing mind, attention to detail. So I would definitely choose him because I think he'd be a really interesting pick. My next one, George Best, although I'd have to say it would be before the alcoholism kicked in, because no one's got that much booze in their cupboard, for goodness sake. He was the first of our celebrity players, really, and I just think it's fascinating. He is clearly a genius. In fact, when he was spotted by the United Scout Bob Bishop, when he went over to Ireland and spotted him, he actually sent a telegram to the United manager, Matt Busby, and it just simply read, "I think I found you a genius." And I think that that's the case, certainly on the pitch, but also off the pitch. He was the first personality, a huge amount of panache and charm, and a very fascinating character, as well as all of the mental makeup issues. You know, he was a real player of highs and lows, and I think he'd be a fascinating guest. I then want to move on, and I seem to sort of chosen a couple of troublemakers here almost. I want to move on to Joey Barton, who'd be my third guest. Now, no one can escape the problems Barton's had off the pitch as well as on it. But look, he's kind of been given a second chance. And what fascinates me about this guy is he's the bloke who quotes George Orwell and Aristotle in his tweets, and is a massive Smiths fan. But is he someone who just knows how to copy and paste off an internet quote page? Or is he someone who really lives by these quotes? And he's also quotes the Dalai Lama, who is perhaps one of the most peaceful people out there. So for a player who likes to get himself into so much trouble, why is he now quoting the Dalai Lama? And is he a reformed character? So I think he'd be a very interesting one too.
OK, we'll move on to Ed and your three guests. And are you cooking?
I will cook, yeah. I'll probably do cheese on toast with a flash of pickle or something equally delightful that will wow my celebrity guests. I'll steer clear of Joey Barton just because I fear I'd get the Hyde side of the Jekyll and Hyde character and probably may be a long night. I'm going right back because I'm interested in the first footballers of the people, live with the people, same, you know, social standing, working class guys. And one of the first stars, really, I think, Billy Meredith, William Meredith, played with a toothpick in his mouth, so he'd be good at the dinner party as well. So, if, you know, afterwards he had a bit of meat or something you want to get out the back of your chops, that'd be nice. But played for Manchester City, played for Manchester United, involved in a betting pre-fixing match scandal, so he's probably good on Pakistan cricket at the moment as well. But I'd like his impressions of the both clubs. I'd like his impressions of the stardom that's afforded to players now, the relative talents they have. How good was he compared to these guys now? And what he feels about the sort of disproportionate rewards that, you know, your average squad player in the Premier League can become a millionaire. And in his day, he probably died a fairly working class guy in 1958, born in 1874. So I'd like that as one guest to sort of take it back and probably have old fashioned stuff like liver and, you know, things from the Victorian era.
I'm not,
yeah, it does, doesn't it? Well, it's him cooking, so I suppose it's his call. And then I'd like to go sort of a little bit further forward. The 1950s, a guy called Garrincha always sort of impressed me on the videos of Pele, actually, in the 1950s, 1958 World Cup. Right winger, I think, had polio and or big childhood illness that restricted him, but he developed into this, probably the best winger in the world in that generation. And it'd be good to see his opinions on coming back from Brazil, his lifestyle, how that would compare now, one of the world's best players, and what he makes of the whole modern era, because he would have been around and seen the likes of George Best explode onto the scene. And, you know, Best, he would have been one that would have been good for me as a celebrity, first celebrity footballer.
And also what he'd make of Brazil now and how it, I mean, if you look at the generation of Brazilian players since him. Oh, yeah,
Robinho, Romario, all these players, and what he made of the behaviour and how they adapted to the wealth and maybe didn't do so well with it. And then the third one I'd like to, because I mentioned I would have liked George Best, but Kate's nicked him, so he's going to be busy. I'd like to look at the celebrity footballer in mind, the ultimate celebrity footballer, David Beckham, in terms of the brand. What was the origins? How did it come about?
Are you getting about style tips, Ed?
I might get some style tips. I might flash out a sarong while I entertain him in that one. But I'd like to sort of know his perspective. You know, was it planned, the whole explosion? Does he feel a little bit embarrassed because, you know, people may not rank him as the best footballer of all time, but he's the best known footballer. And to people that don't know about the game, they would rank him as the best player because they don't know, you know, the reality of the situation, the weird, I guess, explosion around him.
I would also really want to know from him, does he feel that his celebrity status cut short his career at Manchester United? Because I think it's something Sir Alex Ferguson didn't want anymore in his squad. And it's funny how he shipped out those kind of people, the people that wrote books, the people that had all this publicity around the squad. He doesn't like it, yeah. Does he?
And Man United didn't win the league for 4 years when he left as well. So would it have been different for Manchester United as well in that period? You know, would they have won more trophies, more Champions Leagues potentially?
OK, well, I'll go on to mine. And actually, David Beckham did come into an original lineup I had. I was going to have John Terry, Wayne Bridge, and then me and David could just watch what happened and have a little feel under the table.
Nice.
Also, I wanted managers. I mean, Mick McCarthy, Ian Holloway, Neil Warnock, I think some of the best managers we've had in the top flight for a long time. Unfortunately, Ian Holloway, of course, no longer in the top flight. But it would be great to get them all together. Three Northern guys, Mick McCarthy with the Wolves connection. So I had gone down that route. But I've actually gone for three very different people. And I've got an agenda with every single one of them. Phil Jones, future England captain, he's been deemed. I want to meet him. I want to have him round for dinner before that happens. I want to make sure as well he knows not to go anywhere near prostitutes, alcohol, late night, yeah, dancing, all these things that have happened to the generation that we've wanted to win a World Cup or lift a big trophy. So if it's all on his shoulders, I want to be a bit of a mother hen and give him a talking to.
The real Phil Jones, don't you?
Yes, absolutely.
Before Beckhamation happens.
Yeah, because he will, of course, become this huge icon. And already he's been talked about. He's so young. And I'd love to know as well what it's like being a youngster under Sir Alex Ferguson at this time in his managerial career. Because
compared to Ryan Giggs, Sharp, and those people who had the hair throw. Fergie showing up at parties and stuff like that.
Yeah. Exactly. Be interesting. The second one, it has to be a Wolves connection in there, I'm afraid. Robbie Keane. We helped propel his career. He went down to the White Hart Lane and scored plenty of goals, also for Republic of Ireland. We need a few back now. Stephen Fletcher's been on the sidelines for a bit. So I'd like to talk him into coming back to Wolves, firing in a few for us for a couple of seasons. And finally, Martin O'Neill, who seems to be linked with every managerial vacancy going. One comes up within the Championship or the Premier League at the moment, and his name is down there on the list. I want to know where he's intending on going, because he is intending on going to a club. I spoke to someone actually that I was interviewing when Frank Clark was appointed as Nottingham Forest new chairman, and they're saying he's definitely in it for another job. So where does he want to go? What's he holding out for? And also, what does he think of Randy Lerner? I'd love to know what happened there. And of course, the Brian Clough era. I mean, we know that he's one of the modern managers that has shaped himself on the Brian Clough philosophy, and I'd love to know what he learnt from the man, what he's passed on. There's so many people that have said they've worked with Martin O'Neill and taken so much away. Is this Brian Clough era just going to keep going and going? And that's the dinner table full up. I'm doing chicken. What were you doing?
I don't know, actually. I'm rubbish at cooking, so I have to be beans on toast. Although, actually, sausage and mash is my new special.
So out of you two, you've got cheese on toast, beans on toast, and I'm doing chicken. They're all going to come to me, I reckon.
I am a rubbish woman. I'm useless in the kitchen. I'm like a bloke within my relationship. It's often joked about.
Well, that's not doing the stereotype, is it? Any good at all here on the round table? I'm very girly. I'll do Spanish chicken, a little bit of dauphinoise potato. No, I wouldn't. Thanks very much for joining me. Ed, have you enjoyed your debut?
I have. It's been a powerful pleasure. Thank you, Lindsay.
Thanks very much. And Kate, we'll be back again next week.
We certainly will. It's worth asking Ed how feminine he feels on a scale of 1 to 10 right now.
Is the David Beckham sarong coming out?
Well, I felt 11 when I came in, so probably about 14 and a half now.
Go Ed!
Thanks very much. The female take on football. Well, we've established that Kate and Ed need to work on their dinner hosting skills. Cheese or beans on toast just won't suffice. Now, on to my chat with my final score colleague, Jackie Oatley. The female take on football. I'm joined by Jackie Oatley. Jackie, let's first of all talk about how you got into your career. I know that you made a quick change, didn't you?
I did, although it didn't happen overnight. I decided when I was coming up to my 27th birthday, as it happened, that I didn't want to do what I was doing anymore, and that was working as an account manager for an intellectual property company. And I decided I really wanted to work in football and sport in general, and really wanted to work for Five Live, ideally, because I listened to it all the time, news and sport, the whole lot. Absolutely loved it, and I just thought I'd really like to do that, but I didn't know anybody who did it, so I really had to start from scratch and just did lots of research on the internet and googled people who did that kind of work and saw some people starting hospital radio. So I joined up for hospital radio class, an evening class in introduction to print journalism, another one in radio production, and I just spent all my spare time doing as much work experience as I could. I did classes for 6 months, and then after that 6 months, I gave up my job, gave up my flat, and spent a summer sleeping on friends' floors, and decided I really wanted to do it properly, right from scratch. So I decided to go back to university for a year, and moved up to Sheffield, did a postgrad in broadcast journalism. Absolutely loved it. And while I was there, I wrote to all the local radio stations, and BBC Leeds were daft enough to let me in the building. And I started doing non-league football reports with them on a Saturday, and then built that up to doing match reporting. So that when I finished my course, then I had quite a lot of freelance work to go to. I was very fortunate that... Well, I worked really hard, but I was fortunate that people gave me the shifts, really, and it went from there.
How did you find coming into the career later on? Did you think that that was helpful because you'd already got your mindset, you knew what you wanted, or did you feel like you kind of missed out on a few years where you could have been getting some experience earlier on?
I think I was just relieved that I'd finally decided what it was I wanted to do, because I know so many people who just don't know what they want to do. I mean, they could be in their mid, late 30s and they've still not really found something they're passionate about, and they, you know, have good jobs, but maybe don't absolutely love them. And I just thought life's too short, because I'd travelled the world for a year after university and I'd lived abroad, and I knew that there was more out there than doing a job I was so unhappy in. So I just thought, now that I know this is what I want to do, I'm going to go for it. And it was sparked partly by the fact that I injured my knee so badly playing football about a year and a half earlier, and I couldn't then change career then. But I had a lot of time to think about what I wanted to do, because I was at home for 4 months with my leg in the air, and then I was on crutches for 10 months. And I just thought, I really, really want to work in sport. I'd love to be a journalist. And I just thought I'd left it a bit late. And I just thought, well, actually, it's doable. You know, if I work really hard, then I can see. And then at least I'll know. But actually, I found it to be beneficial to be a bit older, because I think in journalism, a bit of experience helps, really. Having dealt with people from all sorts of walks of life and in industry, you need to be confident, really. And I just knew that's what I wanted to do. And I'm just so glad I didn't leave any later, because then I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have done it.
So not only did you choose a career path that was already quite competitive in terms of being journalism and going down that route, but you also chose a sport of football as well, and sport in general, which is, of course, very competitive, also very male-dominated. I know that you're one of the ladies' names that comes up quite often when people think about women in football. Has that been a battle along the way, or how has it been?
Yeah, it's not been easy, it's fair to say, in terms of the pressure from the outside, because you know that you stand out sometimes. I mean, most of the time I don't think about it, and certainly going into it, I didn't really think about it. It might sound stupid now. I knew I wanted to commentate, and I knew no one else was doing it, but it still didn't feel like, oh, I'm going to have to break down some barriers. I didn't think of it like that. I just thought, well, I'm the same as the other blokes in the office in my local radio station. I thought, I'm very similar to them in that I've got similar knowledge of football to them, and I've worked my way up right from scratch. It's not like I've just asked to be dropped in at the top by any stretch. And I just couldn't see why they would go on from doing match reports to commentating, and I automatically wouldn't, which is why I asked my sports editor if I could do it. And it just carried on from there. I think because I thought I could do it, I didn't know for definite, and I thought, well, if I don't give it a go, I'll never know. And I just didn't see myself as any different to the others. But when you get the feedback, then you realise that, OK, there is something a little bit different here. And to other people, it's obviously a big deal, but hopefully not so much now. I don't think it's that big a deal now.
And in terms of your experience being on the road reporting, I mean, you've seen many football matches over the years and watched many players. And I know it's very difficult to pinpoint certain games and memories, but, I mean, there must be some standouts for you.
I mean, so many matches over the years, both as a football fan and as a reporter and commentator. It's not so much the matches that stand out as being brilliant, although actually matches stand out as being awful. You've probably experienced that as well. I remember the worst Premier League game I've ever seen in all my life was Watford 0, Reading 0. Absolutely. And anyone who's there will know exactly what I'm talking about. It was an absolute shock, and both managers said afterwards the same thing. I don't remember brilliant games as such, apart from maybe Algeria, Slovenia in the World Cup, and England were playing at the same time. I was doing that for Five Live. That was fantastic. And it was fantastic to be at the World Cup as well. But it's more stadia that I remember, and occasions. Watching the Champions League last night, I remember going to Bayern Munich, AC Milan. And those are the sort of games where you're pinching yourself thinking, is this really my job? I've just been sent to Munich to report on a Champions League match against AC Milan. And European Championships, Euro 2008, I was lucky enough to be a TV reporter there. And just love every minute of going to big games, or any games really, at any level.
You're a woman of my own heart as well, in the sense that you love every level of football, because you've had a lot to do with women's football. And I know as well that you started in non-league, and just generally the game itself. I mean, when you come across people that are a bit anti-football, what do you say to them? How do you get across your love of the game?
Well, I just wonder what they do with their time. What do people do on a Saturday afternoon? And when I have very, very rarely had an international weekend and you pop to the shops on a Saturday, I think, oh my goodness, is this the alternative? Shopping on a Saturday afternoon, no way. I feel sorry for them in a way. I mean, what do they do to fill their time? How do they get passionate? I'm sure they manage it somehow. But I just can't imagine life without football. And it might sound a bit daft, but I didn't choose to go into football and to get into football. It kind of came up and bit me on the bum one day when I wasn't looking because I didn't have any introduction family-wise and I went to an all-girls school. Nobody I knew was into football. It was really, really strange how I got into it. I just saw a match one day on TV, basically, and was completely hooked straight away and became obsessed with my local team and it all went from there. So I can't imagine a life without football now. But if people aren't into it, most of my female friends aren't, but they still have to follow my team.
The female take on football.
A big thank you to Jackie and to the rest of this week's contributors, Chris Powell, Ed Draper and Kate Borsay. Please make sure you download the Offside Rule podcast for next week.
The Offside Rule We Get It is a podcast produced by Heather Davies and Lindsay Hooper.